This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. As Lithwick warned us, the erosion of American norms is happening on many fronts. The erosion of faith in good information, the erosion of impartiality of federal investigators, the erosion of trust in the law itself. It doesn't help that so many of the president's fans in the media, including Lou Dobbs, are cheering it on.
And by the way, I don't want to hear any crap about an independent Justice Department. This Justice Department, as does everyone, works for the president. It is part of the executive branch.
It's not crap, but it is squishy because it's not backed by law. According to Susan Hennessy, executive editor at Lawfare and co-author of Unmaking the Presidency, Donald Trump's War on the World's Most Powerful Office, long before the tradition of law enforcement independence had coalesced, American presidents often chose who to prosecute or protect.
George Washington actually personally orders the prosecution of certain individuals who were involved in the Whiskey Rebellion all the way back in 1792. And then later, as the case develops over time and the policy equities change, he orders those same charges to be dropped. And so striking examples of a president sort of personally getting down in the weeds of sort of individual cases. John Adams actually orders the prosecution of specific newspaper editors under the Sedition Act. And then when Thomas Jefferson comes to power, he orders those charges to be dropped. And so in the early Republic, there is a rich history of presidents essentially acting like an attorney general. However, we have to keep in mind that the Constitution doesn't say anything about an attorney general. The Justice Department isn't even created until 1870. And so we're talking about a context in which there is no Department of Justice, and there also is very, very limited sort of federal statutory law.
You wrote that there's a pervasive myth that this norm about prosecutorial independence is purely a creature of the post-Watergate era, right? But it actually stems back well before Nixon, all the way to FDR.
So certainly Watergate is the point at which we start to establish rules for how the White House communicates with the Department of Justice. But even prior to that, this notion that law enforcement is supposed to be removed from political interference already is a shared understanding. And one place we can point to is in 1940, Robert Jackson, who later goes on to become a Supreme Court justice, delivers this speech cited by federal prosecutors to this day. The former Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein used to cite this speech quite often. The two sections that are sort of most powerful are when Robert Jackson talks about the most dangerous power of the prosecutor is that he will pick people that he thinks he should get, rather than cases that need to be prosecuted. And this is this really important idea, this notion that prosecutorial discretion can be abused because, really, you could prosecute or at least investigate just about anyone because of this really, really sprawling federal criminal law. And so they have to pick the cases where the proof is most certain and the greatest public good is served. And that within that discretion is where the danger of political abuse creeps in.
In your book, you write, indeed, the soft spot in the federal government, as Trump understood, even if his detractors did not, was not the NSA. It was not any of the programs the agency's prolific leaker, Edward Snowden, had revealed. It wasn't the drone program. The soft spot, the least tyrant-proof part of the government, turned out to be the U.S. Department of Justice. Why was that the soft spot?
Because it is the area in which the protections against political interference are normative rather than statutory, in which the protections really depend on good faith and on people being willing to follow the rules. Because when Donald Trump says, I have the absolute right to do what I want with the Justice Department, as he said just the other day regarding interference in Roger Stone's case, as a constitutional matter and as a pure legal matter, he's actually right. And yet he is describing a deeply corrupt and corrosive vision.
You wrote, without control of the Justice Department, the would-be tyrant's toolkit is radically incomplete. And you quote David Frum, writing about Viktor Orban's Hungary, who describes the system of justice there as essential to Orban's undermining of democracy. Day in and day out, he wrote, the regime works more through inducements than through intimidation. As one shrewd observer told me on a recent visit, this is the part that got me, the benefit of controlling a modern state is less the power to persecute the innocent, more the power to protect the guilty.
Yeah, so this touches on a really important and underappreciated feature of the way law enforcement can be abused. There's a lot of focus on offensive use of law enforcement, right? So the president using the Justice Department to target his political opponents, people like Hillary Clinton, for example. But the defensive side, in which the president cultivates impunity for his friends, Roger Stone can lie to Congress, can lie to federal prosecutors, and that Donald Trump can come in and either through political interference in the sentencing recommendations or potentially eventually through a pardon can erase the consequences for him. That actually undermines the structural separation of powers. It undermines the system by which the president and the executive branch can be held accountable.
We've used some historical examples of presidents who've tried to leverage law enforcement for personal and political use, maybe examples that are too early to be relevant. But as you've noted, Trump does the same thing with more recent examples. Here's one reported by the New York Times in 2018, read aloud here on CNN.
Mr. Trump said he had expected his top law enforcement official to safeguard him the way he believed Bobby Kennedy, as Attorney General, had done for his brother and Eric Holder had done for Barack Obama.
What do you think about those analogies?
The notion that Eric Holder was a politically motivated actor, I would suggest, are not well supported by evidence. That said, certainly the Kennedys had a close relationship, and there is more of a question there.
That's a popular Fox News trope.
President Kennedy made his brother the attorney general, and yet, you know, Donald Trump gets advice from his son-in-law, and all of a sudden that's grounds for impeachment.
Ordinarily, whenever we point to Bobby Kennedy defending JFK or sort of being his politically motivated and highly loyal attorney general, we're describing a bad thing. Congress actually passes the law to prevent nepotism in the federal government as a response to this. And instead, Donald Trump says, I really respect him for that. And so what Donald Trump is expressing admiration for is this deeply corrupt vision by which the attorney general is not the chief law enforcement officer of the United States, but is the protector in chief of the president personally.
That was the central failure of Jeff Sessions.
The original sin that Jeff Sessions committed was the recusal from the Russia investigation. And Donald Trump openly attacks him for this, undertakes this campaign to get Sessions to change his mind. And what we see early on is actually Republicans in Congress pushing back. We see Lindsey Graham say,
if Jeff Sessions is fired, there will be holy hell to pay. Any effort to go after Mueller could be the beginning of the end of the Trump presidency.
And then Graham actually comes up with a new position, which is, well, the president's entitled to have an attorney general he has confidence in, but let's just wait until after the midterm elections. We can actually trace the erosion of constraints and the ability of Donald Trump to increasingly test the limits of the politicization of the Justice Department.
So if we see this slow disintegration in the norm, I mean, we heard Elizabeth Warren vow that if she were president, her administration would investigate Trump. And you think that's a terrible idea. It's, in your view, just a reiteration of Donald Trump promising to lock up Clinton.
Kamala Harris early in the primary made an even more overt suggestion saying that, yes, you know, of course Donald Trump would be investigated. And that's something that I think is quite satisfying and even logical to many people who believe that there is evidence that the president and his administration are committing crimes.
There is evidence, right?
The issue here is not whether or not a prior presidential administration or a prior president would ever be investigated. It's who should be making those decisions mm-hmm. and why and on what basis. And when a political candidate suggests an investigation as part of their candidacy, that is political. We shouldn't want to hear mm-hmm. pledges from candidates to investigate any particular specific individual, whether a political opponent or anyone else.
So how do you propose we begin to reconstruct, rebuild, reconstitute the norm that has worked in the past?
We should want to hear presidential candidates talking about reestablishing these norms by saying that they will appoint an attorney general who upholds the rule of law, shares the values of the apolitical administration of justice, and then the candidate should pledge to not interfere with that person.
Do you think if we had four more years of Trump, it will be very much harder to reestablish those norms?
I think not just harder, but potentially impossible. Throughout the book, we chart the ways in which the American presidency has changed over time. And the way we determine whether or not various presidents attempt to breach norms, whether or not those are just weird blips that occur for 4 years or 8 years, is whether or not future presidents do the same thing. And really, re-election is the form of ratification. When a president breaches a norm and then loses re-election, that is viewed as repudiation by the American public. And so we see later presidents come in and act differently because they get the message. But if he isn't rejected by voters, then politicians will seek to emulate it. There also is probably an opportunity here for Congress. Maybe some of these things that we have relied on as a matter of normative constraint should be incorporated into statutory law and actually become rules that the president is required to abide by.
You gently admonished me earlier for bringing up Washington, given that the country was structured very differently back then. But if we go back even further, as you noted in your book, to the first book of Plato's Republic, then we actually can encounter Trump in a kind of funhouse mirror.
I think it is important that we embrace and examine the full scope of U.S. history, but there's always sort of a temptation to cherry-pick examples,
mm-hmm.
to remove them from their context, and we see Trump defenders doing this quite often, right, sort of pointing to prior presidents that have done particular things, see, look, he's not really all that different, or this isn't really abuse. And you mentioned, Plato's Republic, and this notion of the purpose of justice being to protect one's friends and harm one's enemies, that is something that is repudiated and rejected by Socrates, right? So both the idea that justice is the pure expression of political power or some base notion of karma and people getting what they deserve, that is understood for centuries to represent a corrupt vision. And I think that's why it's really so remarkable that in 2020, we have a president of the United States that openly embraces that vision and carries it out in practice. And I think it's disturbing that we're seeing an increasingly muted response. And if we accept what is fundamentally a corrupt notion of justice, even if all of the processes and procedures look the same, and there's still a Department of Justice, even if we see the same structures, right, a U.S. Attorney's Office and an Attorney General, underneath those structures will be a form of constitutional rot.
Susan, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Susan Hennessy is the executive editor of Lawfare and the co-author of Unmaking the Presidency: Donald Trump's War on the World's Most Powerful Office.